So I hope you all get a page if you haven't printed yourself. And as I said, Irony basically said, "Oh, you call them ID and you never make this ID card. I never made it until this year." The point is, it's not like I try to be cruel to you and not carry the index around. It's for any single QFD book you open. When they talk about Dirac field, there is no index. They might carry this one index to emphasize this one is important. They will not write it out. So you then also, I said, in the future, at some point, if I carry all the indexes, I'll pass out, so to speak. Okay, so I should have. So I guess where are we going? Well, I just realized that it's actually somewhat important to tell you that what Dirac actually did. Remember, I keep saying that's not what Dirac did. That's what people later are trying to say. What's the easiest way to get there? Take a square root. But what Dirac did is, so Dirac don't want this. What's the other side? There's a missing something there. What's there? Perfect. So our little first goal circles is take a look at the Hamiltonian at the first glance at the classical level. Okay? So I will this time write Dirac field with nicely labels restored thing. But see, then it's not as pretty as the Dirac equation you always see. And okay, I'll write it down again, which is nothing but the one you seen last time. Reason we know these index masks exist, is it okay I switch notation? I know that I switch a lot of times you didn't see, but every time I agree with one brick, I re regret. Is it okay to use A and B instead? Not the L and L prime? Oh, you want me to be consistent with the notes?
I think it's okay.
Okay. Okay. Understand. But basically, the idea is that they have some indexes, and but since we're studying some very thing special, which is called the Dirac field, I'd like to change the notation to emphasize it's special. Also, it agrees with some literatures, like some other textbooks. So these are identical, and but so far, the only reason we know there is an index there is because the Dirac algebra. Is that you can't solve it. If this gammas are just numbers, if you can't solve with numbers, the next thing to go is matrix. And if it's a matrix, if there's a matrix here, there better be a matrix here to match it. And there better be a vector to act on. So far, that's all we know. And I'll put this in a box. I'm really not caring about how much you memorize the formula from this course. But by the end of the day, I do want to know the Dirac equation. Okay? No, science doesn't matter. All these signs can be absorbed by definition of a gamma. But the rest of this thing are matter. Okay? If you got a sign wrong, didn't have im, maybe I wouldn't care much. But if you give me a Dirac equation, there's no gamma, then I'll be slightly, well, actually quite mad. Okay. The other thing is for this one, I don't really care if you remember the exact form, but you should remember what this implies. This implies if you take a different gamma, they and take a mute because different the gamma that there's like eta becomes zero. Okay, that's all I want from that. So let's not box that one. Reduce number of the boxes. So, and I distribute these monster IDs is because, yeah, they are tough. Like, it will take you some time to get used to it. So don't feel afraid to look it up, what it is. And I'm so happy if somebody comes with me to argue with me about anything I write on that paper, because I only wrote it yesterday. I must make some mistake. Okay? Argue with me and tell me I recognize this monster wrong in a hurry. Okay. So, in order for this to match that, I'll write this Dirac equation slightly different. Really, ever so slightly different. Yeah? I broke it in parts, and so now they all act on Poisson. And now you can see this is hidden somewhere here. And the rest must somehow belong to the Hamiltonian. Right? So if you can just think, let's multiply by another gamma zero, and then gamma zero square is one, then we extract what the Dirac wanted. And I'm very serious to tell you, it is a couple line. I counted this morning on the notes. A couple line, and you will arrive at that. Yeah, because you want to multiply this, everything by gamma zero. You have some gamma zero everywhere, and you want to move this side to the other side. So Hamiltonian has to be this. So what's the most important property of a Hamiltonian if we call it a Hamiltonian?
Hermitian.
Yeah, Hermitian. How about better be? It's gonna give me an energy. So, okay, this couple more lines. Okay, maybe three lines. You will find out this very interesting result, which is the reason why I decided to tell you this story of Dirac's original thing. Is that if you demand Hamiltonian is Hermitian, you arrive this, and you can check. Of course, the gamma, we used to pick about this Weyl representation, certainly has to do this. And why? Well, there is some interesting side note I'd like to tell you is what Ivan from, 3 or 4 years ago. And he says, well, you told me, I told you actually yesterday, says if I build this, then it's going to be an equivalent gamma matrix. I said, right, this is a definition of equivalence of a representation of that algebra. But he says, apparently it, not all of them will satisfy this, unless these are not every single matrix is going to make this line true because of that dagger. What kind of matrix will achieve that? The ones we like the most. Unitary. So this is mathematically right. But if you actually want it, it says, I want to study the Dirac field, this is no longer true. You are forced to pick unitary. Very interesting. It's very interesting what a Hamiltonian does to us. Yeah.
Could you
repeat why we have the gamma mu dagger condition?
It's you actually have to sort of derive it. So some calculation missing here. So basically the idea is if you look at this term and require it the dagger equals itself because we want it to be Hermitian, then you sort of derive the, what you derive is actually gamma zero dagger is equals gamma zero. And now what you do is look at this term, slightly more complicated, there's i's and two gammas and a partial derivative, whatever. But if you take a dagger and it says demand it to be Hermitian, what you get is actually this. Because you know how other things behave, you must be able to get that. And I mean, it's a good question because you, unless you go through that step, you wouldn't realize those two lines can be written together like this. Because if it's gamma zero, they're just one. If it's gamma I, there's an anti-commute thing from there. So it's just a pretty way to write them like this, but you actually derive them separately. Okay, so this is very interesting. Yeah, I find it very interesting. Actually, the converse is true. They say, given a physical representation that we can use in direct field, it must be linked with a well representation. This is not easy to prove, not even in the notes, but if you really want to know, there's a reference. Schreber, chapter 5. Yeah, well, no, Schreber, the book, but the chapter 5 of the notes, footnote 4, will give you precisely where that book is. It's very complicated. But it's a proof. Says that all the gammas you can use for Dirac field, actually they are all equivalent. In the mathematics point of view, there is only one rep. Because they're all equivalent and then they are bundled together, all the equivalent class. Okay, so, well, with this, Dirac is unhappy again. Because remember what we showed the last time, Psi is okay. Psi is a solution of a Klein-Gordon equation. What does that mean? If you have an ansatz for Psi, which part of Psi do you think you know? It's like you want to solve. Like go back to scalar field and then you solve Klein-Gordon equation. What do you get?
Plane
wave. And since Psi is a solution of Klein-Gordon equation, so this is just going to be very intuitive to assume it also have the plane wave. And the plane wave is right, but Dirac doesn't like it. Dirac says, look at this. This is my energy. And if I look at the plane wave, it tells me my energy can be negative. This is very bad. Why Klein-Gordon doesn't have the problem? Because they have two time derivatives. The energy never show up together. It always show up as E squared. So they have no problem. And Dirac says, I take a square root of the E squared. I have a problem. Which branch I end up? And you know, then there is a story that he says, oh, it's not. It's okay. I'll just assume that negative energy are all filled out because I'm talking about the electrons. So this is going to happen, and I only observe this electron. And I think I mentioned already, if you have a hole and then you get a positron, and he was very successful, the theory was experimentally proved, basically, like in a couple of three, at most of 3 years. Okay. So now is the time I'll tell you a story. This story is credit to, relax, I'm not asking you half questions. It's really a story. And it's credited to my colleague Tibra that now is in Bangladesh, and associate dean in some university. Anyway, I love this story. It says, one day, Schrödinger and Heisenberg and Dirac go fishing. So they went fishing, and then there's a thunderstorm. So then Schrödinger wakes up, get out of the tent, and look at the fish, and try to divide it in three parts. And he realizes it's impossible unless he throw a fish into a fish, back into the water. Then he was like, oh, okay, now I can cut it into three pieces and take my share away and leave. And turns out Heisenberg wake up the next. And he did exactly the same thing. He has no idea Schrödinger has left. He'll be like, this is not an integer like divided by three. I'll just throw a fish away and then divide by three and take my share. And same happened with Dirac. Now there is a question. Where are they fishing? Let me show you this incredible, interesting, basic math manipulation. If you start with minus two fish, it's not divided by three. You can throw one away. And now it's divided by three, and each part is minus one. And if this minus one is taken back, you go back to minus two. So, where do you think in the world you can fish minus fishes? Negative fishes.
Dirac Sea.
Correct. Okay. Kind of cute. So that proof can be more rigorous. I just tell you the solution. If you assume the number is n and that thing is repeatable three times, you only need like twice to show, yeah, that's the only answer. So it could be rigorous. Okay, so back to where we are. Is that actually this point has been pointed out to me on Monday tutorial by a bunch of people. Like almost like half the class, well, maybe the other half just didn't talk to me, but like half of the class says, wait, I just said the psi is good. It satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation. What I have never told you is that the whole equation is good. Only this part has been verified. Solution of Klein-Gordon. What about the whole thing? Okay. Hands exercise. If you think Dirac equation is Lorentz covariant, do this, like a big hand. And if you think Dirac equation is not Lorentz covariant, and give me a fist. Okay, everybody, very good, very confident. Yeah, I mean, if it's not covariant, we're not going to use it for like 70, 80 years, 100 years, right? Okay, but how do we actually prove it? Okay, so this is in a circle. The next topic and the goal is to gather some belief that the Dirac field equation, is actually going to be a solid equation that we can use in special relativity, as in this. Okay, our starting point is Dirac equation, of course. And the question is, how do I prove this thing is a covariant? I want to say that if it's in another frame, then So let me be more specific. Yes, right? The way to say this equation is covariant is now I do a Lorentz transformation of the Dirac field to a Lorentz transformation on the coordinate. It still look kind of like a Dirac equation. And it's actually very look like. Whenever you talk about Dirac field or coordinates and put some prime in, and if you see numbers, you don't put primes. Or something Lorentz invariant mass, then we don't put primes. And a lot of people have the question, why this thing does not transform? Well, I believe that Dirac has been this point. Says, I'd better show my equation is actually Lorentz covariant. And as a physicist, we like to assume the simple things are true. So that's the approach we're gonna take, is assuming this don't transform, and let's say, if we can succeed. If we can't do it, then, well, then we try harder things. Okay. So, very interesting. I want to do it the other way, but that's fine. So what I wanted to do is turn psi mu into psi nu prime. But this is something you learned from relativity, moving index around, index are summed over, have the same index. So these are the Lorentz transformation, and there is that.
There's what?
There is the partial derivative in the new coordinate. So it's like you have a partial derivative in the old coordinate, you have partial derivative in the new coordinate. It must be related to this Lorentz thing. And you can figure out the index using this index contraction thing. Okay. So the first thing I say is I turn this away. And the other thing is I can also get rid of psi x. Because the claim is that only these two underlined things will change. Okay? So if I do that, I'm going to erase this. It just says the Dirac transform some way. And I will get this doesn't do anything, and thus that thing transform. Okay, this is this line with all these things substituting. The only two things that transform. Okay, let's focus on this term. And this term. So how can I make that look the same? This one says m psi prime. This one says I'm m d inverse psi prime. Yeah. Very good. So the second term says I had better do this. Otherwise, the mass term is going to change. All cause is lost. So then the first term, I'm going to put it on this board because my planning is bad. So if you compare the first term, you had better have these D's and D's, and there is a lambda in the middle, and there is still gamma in the middle, and the next line there is only gamma. It doesn't look pretty. And the first thing I recognize is this transformation is not identity. If this is identity, there's identity. There's no way that's true. Wait, if you left it with this and this, chance that it's not gonna work. So we know that it's not a inner trivial representation, which we already know, because these are not numbers. And the next thing to do, okay, let's see. If this
true, like wouldn't the oh never mind. Okay.
This thing show up again. What do you think? Whenever you see this representation of Lorentz group, I hope you already been persuaded there's a natural thing to do. Yeah? Huh? What? That's right. If we don't know if lambda is gonna be a, I don't know, finite transformation, and I have no idea how to solve this, there's one thing we always do. We expand. Okay. I'll say few lines of calculation. It's some amount of calculation, you expand this, you expand that, you have this three things and need to be expanded. And I'm not gonna do that because it's not very interesting calculation. You're just doing linear expansion. But the result is interesting. Okay, so if this thing gave you some J, this one gave you some J, and you probably find out that the commutator will show up. And the other term has two terms instead of one. So you expand the three things. So the first order, you should expect three things, is nothing but we take care of this anti-symmetry and we anti-symmetry this. So yes, it's a few lines. You have to do all the expansion, collect the linear term and put it together and find the anti-symmetric part. But whatever, like when all the dust settle down, this is where you get. Do you recognize this? Have you seen this somewhere?
In the homework or the tutorial?
It's in the tutorial. It's in tutorial 3. Remember I said, oh, these are some calculations that you want to check later, but don't go back? And this thing shows up. And the direct consequence of this is we know the solution. The solution is a commutator with some coefficients, which is harder to decide what the coefficient, but the commutator is clear that will give me two index and it's anti-commuting. So this is a phenomenon because we start with a Dirac equation. We have absolutely no idea how does it transform under Lorentz. And we found out this. So which representation would they be transformed in? Spinner. This we tell that's the time we say, wow, Dirac is spinner. Previously we have no idea this conclusion. We only know about this equation and the algebra. And if no mathematician tells us that Dirac algebra indicates a spinner rep, it doesn't matter. We don't need the mathematicians. We just computed ourselves. It's right here. So this is a very good result. We know, I have to say some gibberish and says that if you calculate and compute J12 and you realize it's spin half. Yeah.
Why does the lambda commute with partial mu?
Because partial mu needs an x to act on, and the representation of a group member has no x dependence.
The Lorentz transformation gamma will have velocity term.
What?
The Lorentz transformation gamma will have one upon the root 1 minus u squared.
Yeah, exactly, but your velocity is fixed.
It's fixed.
It's a fixed. It's not going to change. Right? That's called a different inertia stream. And if you change, you have to go to GR. So these are things that are just numbers. Well, okay. I was in a very deep conversation on Monday. And then says that that's where the email come from, that if you find the operator, that sometimes you will find this, for example, J3 will act on the Hilbert space, but that's because that you calculate J3 and you quantize it and you look into it, it has a dagger 8. And you still need all the creation annihilation operator to actually to acting on the Hilbert space. Okay, so now I find that this is an amazing result. Don't you agree? We know it's a spinner. And then I'll just briefly say, this is exactly the opposite with what we did in the first half. First half, we started with a spinner representation. And eventually, we'll find out super psi. It's like the inverse QFT thing. This, we started with equation. We know such field exists. And we ask, what a representation? It's a spinner. But in the first half, we pick the spinner representation and then go backwards, and eventually it gives us the equation of motion. So it's really like one is QFT and the other is inverse. Okay. So there you go. So now we know this equation is good. So if you know a good equation, what do you want to do? It's a good equation. You're not going to be like, even if you do something with this equation, you're not going to be in the future says all your work is wasted because the equation is not good. But now this equation is good.
We still have like the negative energy issue though, right? If we choose, or we need a solution that doesn't give us negative energy, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that will come later.
Okay.
Much later. Yeah, is it much later? It's just not going to happen. Now, actually, the majority of the calculation will give you this non-negative energy is in your choice 2 of homework 2. So yeah, it's a very important question. And unfortunately, we have to somehow ignore a daunting minus infinity that under the carpet. But if you agree, we can sweep infinity into the carpet. We'll be good. Okay, and but if you have an equation, what do you want to do? If you have like 2x equals 1, what do you want to do?
To solve
it. See, very logical idea. If and turns out, okay, I used to ask use actually solve it in class. And then realize that the technique of solving it is not very enlightening. Even the result is not very enlightening because you have to pick a specific representation for gamma to solve it. So your result would be gamma dependent. And we don't like anything that is rep represented, like rep dependent. That's why I'm not going to just show you how to solve it. I'm not even going to show you what is the solution. There is one important thing about this. Like, I'll just tell you what's the most important. The most important thing is this thing doesn't solve. Unlike in the scalar case, plane wave actually doesn't solve it. Why? This part is useful to look at. Why that the plane wave is not a solution of the Dirac equation. What are we looking for?
Vector.
Spinner? Oh. Because now we know it's a spinner.
All right.
We're looking for a spinner. This thing is a function. So you are forced to go with a U to go with it. And if this thing you can solve. Like your answers cannot just be played with. It better be in the spinner. And you can solve for that spinner. And on the other hand, you have the other plane wave. And you have to get something else to go with it because the same thing doesn't solve it. If you solve it, the solution is not the same. So that's the important part, is you know the solution contains some spinners and commonly known as U and V. And the other thing interesting is that these U and V all look very nicely as if it's two smaller spinners. It's like if you look at the solution, you will realize somehow the upper half can change and the lower half can change, but they don't talk to each other. Because in which scenario that will happen? Because well represent, well, it is always a reducible representation, but in well, it's screaming in your face because it's block diagonal. So that's why we like well so much. And I think that's all the interesting part. Well, the most interesting part is that there are some spinner identities. Derivation of them are, so see, here is where I stand. And if you're like, I'm super enthusiastic about a QFT and I want to check all the derivation that you give me, I would say excuse yourself from this if, you know, to save some time. It's, you can do a couple and you will realize that they are all the same technique and it's very repetitive. So I don't really want to know what exactly the solution is. I don't really want to know how to derive them. I don't want to know how to turn them into spinner identities, but I want you to know how to use it. It's like an integration table. You know how to do integration, but do you actually want to check all of them? Maybe you're super interested to check a couple just to make sure I didn't derive it wrong. But if you open any book, any QFT book, you will see these spinner identities. And what I need you to do, especially if you're choosing choice two of the homework two, is when you see such things in your calculation, which is like a UU bar, U bar U, and stuff like that, you'll be like, oh, I need to open my integrated table of the spinner identities to find the one to use it. Okay, this is really not the most important calculation you can do. It's more algebra than useful. But what I want to do is to say, suppose I have these solutions, I can do this thing, is to write down the mode expansion. And right, this is how it works in scalar fields, except we have all this funny funny U and the V's handing around. But the point of mode expansion is to say, if you have some solutions, I can find some linear coefficients to match with them, and hence get a Dirac field. Well, we know they're going to depend on, we don't know they're going to depend on momentum, but to be safe, it's integrated over momentum. We will make them depend on moment. We do know that they depend on moment. Okay, sorry. In the scalar field case, you do know they are depending on momentum. But this time, we'd better have a spin index because the Dirac field itself has no spin index. It has to lose the spin index somehow. And the easiest way is to come up with another thing as a spin index and it's summed over. So this is an important result. Is that this is some solutions we don't care, this is some solutions we don't care. But to assemble a field motivated by the scalar case, we need some linear coefficients. This is used to be called the A and A star.
Can I have a question?
Yeah.
Is there an easy way to see why we are in a reducible representation instead of irreducible?
Because you computed this. It's block diagonal. And if you continue computing, you will realize that's true for the other two. And if you continue computing, you will realize the boosts. Also, they are all block diagonal. If you have all the generators are block diagonal, that's only indicating one thing. Okay, so. Okay, we're just gonna sit on this a little bit. And well, this will be very useful for the second homework, the Hamiltonian version of second homework. But I think it's good that we take a break. Let's start. I'm sorry that I wrote it in the standard way, but at this point in our life, it should be written like this. There is a solution, that's the coefficient. That's a solution, that's a coefficient. That's how we take a linear combination. It's just, I'm too used to write the other way. But this, hopefully, will be directly analogous to this, which you have seen. With some integral and sum, and there's no sum, whatever. Okay, it's this. Except in the scalar case, you don't need something to go with the plane wave. So spinner, okay, let me write this. Is a column of four numbers. Okay, so you need to find something like U1, U2, U3, U4 to go with it. If psi looks like this thing, you have to have something in your mode expansion to carry on to have also this thing. And that's where the index comes, but you don't have to write it the index way, you can just write it like that. Okay.
We got a
question. Yeah.
If like, the J's are reducible and we're working with a reducible representation,
yeah.
How come we don't? Why do
oh my God, you just like asked, I don't know how many dollars question, but like $1 million for me, because that's what exactly we're going to do.
We're
going to
reduce it.
Oh, okay. Wow. It's always nice, you know, what we're going to do next is said by one of you guys, not me. And by me, it's less interesting. So we're going to reduce it. And the result is called a wild spinner. Makes sense. That's why the presentation, the representation is called a wild representation. Okay, let's reduce it. So the first thing I want to point you out is something along the lines of this, but this time I'm actually going to write it out in the group way. So, if you have a rotation, then you end up having like this. Yeah? If you have a boost, and this you can have a leap of faith, And the result is this. I mean, none of these are very fancy. That all the computation you know how to do, you have already do the 1, 2, and if you have any doubts, check all the other 5. Okay, and I'm just going to write it in a way that it's like all the angular momentum is organized and all the boosts are organized. And the biggest thing to realize is there is an I and there isn't. What that I will do for us? Why is this I super important? Yeah? Yeah, that's right. If you have an I, which means it's unitary, without, it's not. So, but anyway, as Pacha pointed out, why don't we reduce it? Of course we should reduce it. We find some irrep and we don't do anything about it. That would be my shame. So let's do it. And I'm just going to write this out. It's a block diagonal computation, and I hope that's okay. Hopefully that's okay. Okay, let's reduce it. It says this Poisson actually have an upper half and a lower half. And see, it doesn't matter when they rotate. They are exactly the same. And the boost, slight difference. Well, the slight difference is telling that we can't choose this to be exactly the same. See, if rotation boosts, they are all exactly the same, then there's no point to have two of them.
I'm a bit confused. Why are most rotation boosts generated by sigma matrix?
Well, you calculate it. It's because we're choosing. Okay, very good. Very good. That's because we're choosing the wild representation. If you remember, wild representation, it's just a bunch of sigma. Right? You are either doing this to get a boost, clearly only sigma, or you do it within itself, but you know sigma times the sigma and the commutator, whatever, is going to be sigma. Which is good, because we just realized, we say that it's going to be a spin half. I mean, if we have something spin half and the sigma doesn't show up, then that's one way worry. Okay. The question is, we pick a specific representation. We don't like anything that depends on a specific representation. So the question is, again, show of hands, this is say, we can do it in any representation. And this says, no, you have to stay with Welch. Some sort of this, not a cutting, like a upper half and lower half. If anything remotely like this is going to happen, give me a hand. And if you say no, the other representation was screwed, then give me a fist. Okay. Okay, again, completely, you know, basing on historical reasons. If this well spinner has been passed on for 100 years, it had a better be more useful than this. It's a thing independent of the representation. But the question is, how do you do it? Right? So basically what we're saying is psi is equal to W plus W minus. And the W plus happens to be zero downstairs and W minus happens to be zero upstairs. And the idea of while spinner, well, in one way that you kind of know it's going to be true, right? If you are, say, I'm in another gamma, some representation, but they're related with unitary transformations. If gamma is related with all these unitary transformations, you would think psi is also related to this with some sort of transformation between a gamma and a different gamma. And as long as you have belief in that, what we need is actually try to find what do they get transformed to. So they will, the property is that we can still write down something like this, like they never talk to each other. See, the most important is plus remain plus, minus remain minus, plus remain plus, minus remain minus. That's the important part. That's what gave us the belief that they are smaller irreps that we can use for. So the most important thing is that, the technique. This technique, you have seen this technique. So I'll give you a, so this technique is like, I have a vector, I separate it into two vectors. Yeah? This is something you have done before. So what does this remind you?
Projection.
Right? This thing. You can just use this to pick out the part of the state you want. So what we're looking for is a projection operator that has the following properties. When I square a projection operator, what do I get? You get itself. That's good. If I project another time, there's nothing to project. It stays the same. And another good property is if I add the two projection operator together, I will get
one.
I get a one. And then the other good property is if I do a plus and then I do a minus, I get
zero.
So what do we need to do if I want to know that if this Dirac field can be always separated into some Weyl field, is that I have to find this projection operator. And there is one more thing. That is actually the most important thing about this projection operator. Suppose I'm in a rest frame, and I manage to project with P plus P minus into some normally called the psi plus and plus minus. And now I boost, or take a boost, take a rotation, go to Mars, do whatever. And then it's no longer projected anymore. That's not gonna be good, right? Once you have a projection operator, it better be Lorentz invariant, right? It's all about the special relativity. So now what I want to find is this. Okay.
Sorry.
So a projection operator. So as I said, the most important thing is we'd better not lose Lorentz invariant. Once I did this separation, it better stay like that once it starts to travel. So this is very interesting. So basically, so how do you get something that is Lorentz invariant? Like Lorentz transformation is generated by Lorentz generators. What do you think our P and there's a relationship between the Lorentz generator? What do you think the relationship is? They commute. Okay, this thing, as I said, I'm not going to write the constant, But this thing is the commutator of that. So it turns out to commute, so now we have two choices because now we have a pair. Before it's a commutator, now if you it's a pair, then commute would certainly work. If you have find something commuted with all the gamma, that will certainly work. But there is also the other choice, is to I'm saying there's P and the gamma. So if I can show you this commute, P commutes with all our gamma, that's certainly okay. But that's not gonna happen. If it commutes by some sure less lambda, it's gonna be identity. Well, identity is also good. Let's remember that P can contain identity. But identity alone is not good. If you have identity alone, you're not projecting anything. So I had to find the other thing. So I said that the identity commutes with all the gamma matrices so that P is commuting with gamma matrices. But there is also the other choice. What's the other choice? Think about it. You have like
P is a gamma matrix.
How could you commute with a pair of things? Okay, let me tell something completely irrelevant, but the two fermions is a boson. What does that tell you? Besides commuting? You can? Anti-commute. If this is true, that's okay.
Why this
would be true? Well, actually, there is some other lemma. I think it's also sure. It is really, I have to read it because I can't remember it. Sure's lemma says, if matrix commute with So why this would be true? Okay, Schur's lemma doesn't tell us. Schur's lemma just tells us that we will find something commuting with that. Schur's lemma says if matrix commuted with all the matrices in the E wrap, then this matrix is identity. But we're not in the E wrap. So there's gotta be something we can call to the projection operator that's gonna commute with the generator. No, sure, Mama didn't tell us. But this is our only choice. You can show that besides identity, there's nothing going to be commuting with gamma because gamma forms their own algebra. And then you have to find something anti-commute with all of them. All of them. So I don't know about this motivation, but I can try to think about it. But if someone says I found it, this is the fantastic fifth matrix. It says if you just multiply them all together, they will anti-commute. I think those are some conventions that will look nice later. Don't worry about numbers. It just says if you multiply all of them, you will anti-commute with all of them. I mean, this is right because it's going to this thing you can show. As an exercise, actually, it's in your quiz, that this is a very good exercise. Really understand the Dirac algebra. When you change two things, if not the same, you get a minus sign and all that. So, yeah.
I don't understand why the only choice we have for P is for it to anti-commute if it doesn't commute with the gammas itself. Why is that unique? How would we know?
Yeah, the unique, it says if you want to commute with all the gamma, your identity. And no, I'm not sure why you can't find another one that's identity.
I'm saying that he has to commute with all the gammas. I'm saying, okay, that would be identity, but
yeah.
Why, if we're not going to have that, why the first equation implies the second equation?
I think.
I know the second equation.
No, I think if you use some commutator, anti-commutator identities, you can write this line as either some commute or anti-commute.
The second one, the first one is satisfied.
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you to do, is to expand this and write all the possibilities. There's only like four terms. And you can combine them and recombine them, and then you realize that either this is true or that is true. Like it's very hard. There are basically like six, like all the choice, this one can choose 1 to 4 and this one like 6 choices. You have to show that this projector is commuting with all the 6 generators. And one way to satisfy that is write the 4 terms, trying to recombine them, see the commutator or anti-commutator to shows up. And it would be certainly much easier to find something like this rather directly try to solve that. And also, like, we really don't have that much ingredients. If you don't want to introduce extra things, introduce extra, I don't know, gamma prime, if matrices somehow help you to build this P. But if you say, all I'm going to use is identity plus the 4 gamma I already used, because you are already making the theory not as pretty as Klein-Gordon. You already introduced 4 matrices. And the idea is that try to use these 5 ingredients and see what we can get out of this. Okay, so this has some many, many good properties. It squares to 1. It's Hermitian. And it commutes, which is the most important one. But once you have this, we're in business. We claim, this is what we claim. We want this, which is the projection operator. And we have 2 ingredients, identity, certainly commute. And the gamma phi, it anti-commute with gamma, so commute with J. So we have 2 ingredients. I mean, when we have 2 ingredients, what do we try?
Linear combination.
See, this just technique comes back again and again. And this happens basically, I mean, you can do the most general thing. You have A identity, B gamma 5, and all X, Y, whatever. And you want to satisfy all this. That will fix your coefficient. And the reason why gamma 5 has such a weird, yeah.
Why? I know that gamma 5 satisfies all the conditions that we had for P, but why is that unique? Is that unique to reclaim that, or if?
Well, I'm saying that if you only use these 4 matrix, you are probably not going to get something else. Because you remember, like, okay, let's look at how this is going to anti-commute with gamma 0. It's because this one is identity, and these 3 anti-commutes. You have all the number of anti-commutes, you anti-commute with gamma 0. But this argument works for all 4 of them.
Yeah.
But that means if you delete a pair, it's not going to work. Right? Because every to anti-commute with each individual one, you need the support from the other 3.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to imagine you can use fewer than 4 gamma matrix to make something like this. And then once you agree that the 4 is the minimum number of gamma matrix you need to use, that means, you're out of luck because they all square to be 1 or -1. Having more is not going to help you. You're just going to get something you already proved. So my proof is,
even if you multiply that by other gammas because of the commutation relationship,
you can just bring them to be a pair, the pair annihilate to one. Okay, we'll actually come back to that very specific that conversation a little later, next Monday, that things can annihilate and become one. That will come back very importantly, in a very important way. It basically tells us the fermion interaction you want to write on the building block is finite. See, this, you can go whatever. How do you write a Poisson interaction? That's going to be hard. So, but the final thing I want to conclude with this well representation, well spinner, is that you can check that in the specific representation we choose, that it looks exactly what you expected. It projected to just the upper block. It projects to just the lower block. And now you can say, I know how to do it. In any other rep, you pick a rep, I compute a gamma, and do this. Then I get this. Okay, I should write this. This is sometimes just called the Poisson plus minus. And then what do they claim? Is those two things under Lorentz transformation is not going to mix up. Okay. So yes, we reduce them and we'll have fun with well spinners for a whole tutorial tomorrow. Well, it's more like we have fun with Dirac, and it's like the punchline is about a well spin. So when we think about left-handed Dirac, does it work? Does it not? No, it doesn't. And well, it works. Since it's in a tutorial, I'll leave it as a cliffhanger. So now, I need to. So Dan is back. I hope I still have it. Where is Dan? I lost him. Oh, Dan's back. Dan says that I still want to play the game, and this time, okay, it's written, you know, pre-Weinberg. So some of the things here is not going to be correct. But he says, this time I'm going to choose the other action. My electron is going to emit. Wait, stop interrupting me. What is the matter this time? But if your electron is going to emit something, then you will start out with one particle and then with two. What is wrong with that? What is wrong? That means we have to give up the idea of particle being fundamental in the use field. Otherwise, causality is doomed. I feel that. In Dan's recipe, what's the first step? In your own recipe, what's the first step to quantize a field? Choose a Lagrangian. So what is our Lagrangian? Let me think. In scalar theory, it's just phi to the n, so I guess our first proposal Lagrangian is psi square. What? What is psi square? This doesn't make any sense. Because it's psi is something like this. So psi square is definitely a wrong choice. What do you think a correct choice? Yeah, see, this is more likely to be true, but at least you know it turns the psi around and make not this. This is not a Lagrangian. Lagrangian has to be one thing, not a column, not a row, not a matrix. So this, of course, will be the first try. Okay, before I start this calculation, which I will skip many steps, but nevertheless, this is the first calculation you really want to follow and fill all in the steps, because this is the first calculation that will show up in your interview. Most of the time, I'll just be like, okay. You could just be, Now I compute this, I get that. I don't remember what I get. I'll be like, you get this, move on. And this year I might not even remember, but I'll just be like, open my own notes, says, you get this, come, move on. But this is the one calculation you're not gonna supposed to remember everything of them. It's cut it into small pieces, but every single small piece, as I have told you, I have the right to ask. And you will be guided with, you know, take a dagger of this equation. What is the mu nu? As long as you say commutator, let's move on. It's not going to be you have to remember those like 10 lines or 15 lines by heart. It'll still be guided. It's just not even like some of the other time when we're in the interview, I wouldn't even bother to ask that. This is the first, well, because Dan told us the first step is find a Lagrange. I mean, it's like everything we have done so far about the Dirac field is try to land here, just to land the spot that we can find the Lagrange. And everything afterwards is because we have the Lagrange start to compute. It's really the most important computation. So I'm not going to do it like completely for you. I'm just going to show you the key step. The key step is that I assume Psi transform, you're going to get this. This one from Psi, this one from Psi deck. And see, if only this thing equals the inverse, then we're done. Can it be the inverse? If it's the inverse, that tells us, right, of something like that, you answer deeper level of question. My question is just trying to say if this happens,
it's unitary,
and we know it's not a unitary. So, but what we know is that no, if this happens, we will have boost. We don't, right? So the thing is no, they can't. For example, this will be a very important point I ask you in the interview. And d dagger equals d inverse. If it equals, we'll have a different Lagrange. It'll be a much easier Lagrange, but it's just incorrect. So the first thing you want to show is this. It's related. Okay? I'm not going to tell you how is it related. It's all in the notes. As you can show, besides some gamma zeros, they are related. And okay, I can tell you that is because this, the generator is related that way. And for this, you need to take a dagger of the definition and see what happens. And where is my result? There. That's where this thing comes in play, because you know how gamma dagger goes. So with that information, you must be able to compute this. And with this information, by doing some linear expansion, you must be able to compute that. And these computations are important. Every time if this is not computed correctly, we'll end up with a different Lagrange, which would be incorrect. So, with the knowledge of this, I can actually write this down. And no. It's right. It doesn't emphasize the point. Here we go. So this step is simple. I grab that thing, that the result that I hope you all go to compute, and you put it there. And this is what I get. And you're like, only if this thing will meet that, right? Then it can disappear. And so what do we need? There is something in the middle. It's kind of annoying.
Maybe another gamma is not,
because
then it'll turn that into
gamma. Yeah. See? One of the most famous gamma not comes into play. Says if I just insert a gamma not there, annihilate. Oh, you have a gamma not to match with that one. So Dirac Lagrangian is very famously defined as this, where there's this very famous definition is exactly what you just did. And you can actually show that with this Psi bar, you can do so many things. So many things. You could just throw a gamma in it. What you can show is that if this happens, then this one will do that, right? So if somehow this happens, you just say this thing together transform very properly as think about this thing as a blob has a mu index, and it become this that I can't do anything but another blob with a mu index. So what does this tell us? It's a vector. So gamma mu is just a bunch of numbers. But if you sandwich them between psi bar psi, it will actually transform nicely as a vector. You're like, you didn't even show that. I don't need to, because it appears before. Here we go. That. To convince ourselves that Dirac's equations are covariant, we already need to prove that. I already proved that. So now I can just directly use. And it says, well, I get a vector as long as I get a gamma between psi bar psi. And this will come back next Monday too. But I just want to write my conclusion somewhere. The conclusion is today we found our Lagrangian. It is written in the hope that if you do the Euler Lagrangian equation thing, you will get a Dirac equation. Or the easiest thing is put the Dirac equation there and put something else there. So, and this this term is invariant. Because that says if you have a gamma zero and you turn a dagger into a bar, it's invariant. And this one says if you put a gamma in between, it's going to transform as a vector. But you have a partial derivative there, so it's going to be a Lorentz invariant. And that, okay, let's put it in a box. And that's all what I all did from when I start the part two. And that's the punchline. Now we have a Lagrangian. We can go through all the other parts of the recipe. Think about dance recipe. If you started with a Lorentz invariant Lagrangian, what do you do, actually? Let me ask you. Yeah? In dance recipe, you start with a Lagrangian. So you don't have to think about that. Think about it something more pleasing. Okay, very good. You're jumping directly to my point. There is an intermediate step. Yeah. There's a momentum you need to compute. And then you get your Hamiltonian. And once you get a Hamiltonian, what do we do? Yeah, almost before commutation. It's that, right? You put the mode expression, throw it in the Hamiltonian, and say, what do you have? You turn them into operators. Well, not yet. They are still staying coefficients for our case. And that is basically your second homework, is to take that, turn into a Hamiltonian, put the mode expansion in, turn into the Hamiltonian out of operators. And that's the entire second choice of the homework. And then we'll find a crisis. And then you'll realize the way to fix the crisis is to assume a instead of commutator. And that's why that second homework give you the same, the second choice will give you the same result. You'll prove that this thing is firm now.
We don't have this in the first version?
We don't have Lagrangian in the first.
Okay.
I need to read a lot more to get to the point that Weinberg says canonical quantization. Maybe Lagrangian. But yeah, for the parts I read, we don't have.
So, but you know that our ultimate goal is to have our anti-commutator and define our states. And that's where we started. And we complete the circle, and we'll be happy, and then moving on to interactions next week. So tomorrow we're going to complete the circle.